My name is Tanya Ina Denere. The date is Thursday, the 13th of April, 2017, and today I'm joined by Lorraine Leeson at the University of Westminster as part of the GLC Story project. Lorraine, could you please spell out your full name and then tell me a little bit about your background, please?
L-O-R-K-I-N-E-L-E-S-O-N. What sort of background do you want?
Where were you born and where did you grow up?
Okay, I was born in West London. I was born in Middlesex Hospital, actually, in central London. Grew up in West London. Really didn't like it. There was no sense of community. I didn't mind it when I was quite young and we lived in a block of flats, which had communal gardens. Then we moved to a house that was sort of in a suburban street and spent my teenage years there. And I think as soon as I came to East London in my early 20s, I felt I'd come home because I really liked the feeling of all the overlapping communities. And as an artist then, I felt able to do things because there were sort of social networks, there was cultural networks, political networks. You know, there were people who you could engage with on a different levels. And I've been living and working in East London ever since.
Tell me a little bit more about those political networks, cultural networks and social networks.
Well, I first came to Bethnal Green when I was doing a film video fellowship. I started life as a student. I studied fine art through photography, film, and video. And so on this fellowship, the remit was to work with groups in the community. I was working with my ex-partner, Peter Dunn, who was also an artist. And so basically we were told to go and borrow the equipment from various places and set up the network and set up the groups ourselves. But it just seemed that it was so easy to do that compared to when I'd actually tried to work in my hometown in Ryswick. Project there, but felt that there weren't so many sort of groups and organisations, there wasn't so much activity. So we ran a number of workshops, and then out of that, the Bethnal Green Hospital went into occupation, and the Trades Council, his name's Dan Jones, came and asked Peter and I if we would run one of our workshops in the hospital. And make it one of our workshops. What they really wanted was a campaign videotape. So that was my sort of introduction to be working to what felt like in a meaningful way outside of art institutions. As a student, I didn't want to do what I saw my sort of teachers doing, which was to just do my own work and sell it in the gallery. I didn't want to work the gallery going public. I wanted it to be for a wider public, but I also wanted to make a difference. So I've been looking for ways to do this. I met Peter there, and together we made some attempts to do this work outside institutions, but it wasn't until we went to Bethnal Green and started that work with the Bethnal Green campaign that actually we found a way of doing things that seemed to make sense.
You mentioned that you wanted to make a difference. When you were working in Bethnal Green, did you have any particular intentions or goals?
Well, for the workshops, that was simply to run the workshops. But in terms of the Bethnal Green Hospital campaign, the intentions and goals of that of the campaign, because we've been trained as artists and we knew our history of art, we also knew we were aware of how powerful art can be and how it is very good at conferring power and authority. If you only look at sort of 18th century paintings of landowners standing in front of their stately home, you know, you see how art has been used to and you look back on a whole load of portrait paintings, how art is used to give people a sense of dignity, authority. And we thought, well, if it's been used in the past for powerful people, why can't we use it for people who we think are important? So we knew there was a power that art has that perhaps we could bring to something like a campaign. We were also aware that on the left in this country, the tradition has been very much a literary one. That is, if there was a campaign, there would be broadsheets produced, so written material. The imagery hadn't been used so much on the left as on the right, because the advertising at that time, since the late 70s, was really rising at the time. So the right was using visual imagery very powerfully, but the left wasn't. And we thought, well, there is something we can bring to this that isn't being done at the moment. So perhaps that's our aim, is to bring the power of art to something that we believe is an important cause.
And what was the response to that use of visual imagery?
Well, let's say it was in stages. So the first thing was we were invited to do a video. I should say all this work is actually going to be on at the ICA next month. There's an exhibition in the ICA reading room documenting all this, all the work, the health work we did in the 70s. And I've just seen the tape, I've just seen the video we did. So we started off doing the video because that's what we've been asked to do, which was a real learning curve in a way, because they asked us to do it as one of our workshops, because that means we were funded to do it. But on the other hand, they needed a very good campaign video. Well, there was a contradiction there, because if you're running workshops, people need to be able to fail. They need to be able to learn. And so how do you put together a participatory workshop with something that needs to produce, a production that needs to be made very quickly and well? And so we came across the issue there of whether participation was a useful method, and decided at that point that it probably wasn't. Now, I've come back to participation in a big way since, but at the time it seemed that it would be better to collaborate directly with the campaign committee. They were the people who really knew the issues. We knew how to represent them, and together we could probably do that much more efficiently. So it may not be the best place to hold a workshop. Anyway, we managed the videotape, and we edited out all the camera shake and whatever that happened in the workshop. And we produced a campaign video. But it was because we were just there, and we were around the campaign, we were out on all the marches, we were documenting what went on, that we then sort of just became part of it. And so the next thing was the committee asked if we would make some posters. Now, we had all our photographs, so we made some posters. We combined the images. I don't know why we arrived at photo montage, really. It was a practical thing to do. We had a very small, dark room in the basement of our Short Life house, going to some very small photos, so it may have been that. But also, we were aware of the work of artists such as John Hartfield, who had worked very successfully in the 30s and 40s. Obviously, he worked around the issues of the Nazis and capitalism. He worked much more in a journalistic tradition than we did, but nevertheless, we were influenced by that work. And we also had looked around to see what other artists were working for social change, any historical precedent. And we came up with the Russian Constructivists. So we were quite influenced by people like Rodchenko, Eisenstein, artists. Well, it was an era when art and culture were seen as very much part of the struggle. And so that was quite important to us. And actually, if you see any of the posters, you'll notice the influence of the Russian revolutionary artists. So we did the posters. And that was a good experience. The committee paid for the printing. We just put them together. And then we noticed that people didn't really understand why the hospitals in occupation or what that meant. You might need to cut this out, because I'm just going to say to you, we can cut this later if you want, is that I'm carrying on about the whole history of work until you stop me. So at the moment I'm still in the late 70s, but I'll carry on. So we noticed that people didn't really recognise why hospital was an occupation and what an occupation was. What it means is that it was the first wave of cuts in the National Health Service under a Labour government, and they were cutting small community hospitals, and they were bringing all the resources together into the big teaching hospitals. But there was a lot of arguments for why community hospitals are a good idea. In fact, recently it has been in the press, and we have politicians saying what a good idea it would be to have small community hospitals and take some of the pressure off the big hospitals. Don't mind. I think most people who worked in the hospital realised it was a very good idea to keep it, but it was a rationalisation process. So what happened is, in cutting the hospital, the administrators left. But legally, it turns out that if there are still patients in the hospital, and then the staff there have responsibility to look after them, and if GPs keep referring patients, and ambulance drivers keep bringing the patients, and people keep arriving for care at the hospital, then they have to be treated. So if you have all the health workers in the area on your side, the administrators leave and the hospital just keeps working. So this was quite a broad campaign. It was very well organised and had all those groups involved, the GPs, the medical staff, non-medical staff, and so therefore the hospital was seen to be in occupation. But that wasn't obvious. I mean, that's quite a complicated thing to know. So we thought, well, what we can do is produce an exhibition. So some very simple visual panels we can put in the hospital foyer so that when people come in, they'll understand, you know, what it is, what's going on. So we used all those photographs we've gathered in the process of doing the other work and on the marches and everything else. And we produced a series of exhibition panels, and they went in the hospital for it. Interestingly, at that time, there was sort of interest in the art world in political work. When I say the art world, I don't mean mainstream art world, but there was factions in the art world there were some interesting political artists working. And an art critic, Roger Cork, was curating at that time an exhibition for the Serpentine Gallery, so quite a mainstream gallery, called Art for Whom, and questioning about who art was for. And he asked us if we would show the Bethnal Green work in the gallery. And we felt really rather worried about that, because we thought, you know, it's taken us all the time to get out of the art institutions. It doesn't feel right to then show the work there. So we weren't sure, so we took the proposal to the hospital committee, who were absolutely adamant that we show the work there. They said, because it will just widen our audience, people will understand what's happening and what's going on. So I could see that point, and actually it was very useful to do that, and I have had no qualms about showing in galleries ever since. Because in a way the work isn't produced for the gallery, hardly ever produced for a gallery. And so therefore, showing documentation of that work in the gallery isn't an issue. It's also the case that galleries are where people go to see what's going on in the arts. And so if all this work is absent, then nobody knows it's happening. So I think it's important to keep a foot in the art world and to let the art world know there is another sort of way of working. And Peter and I carried on writing for art journals and making this point whenever we could, because we believed what we were doing was art. We could see a history of where it had come from. We felt it was the next step for the art world really to be engaging more directly with the public. If you think about it, the way art is in society at the moment, it's seen as an individualistic activity to produce objects that are saleable on the art market. Well, that's simply capitalism. You know, we looked at our art history and realised that it was for less than 500 years in the West that artists had been doing this, working as individuals to make saleable commodities. We only look back to the Italian Renaissance, and artists are working in team and producing work on the streets in the form of murals and sculptures. Even though it's the church and state, it was still a completely different way of working, and the artists, you know, were training up younger artists in their studios. And so we just thought, you know, we shouldn't worry too much about the fact that there's half the art, most of the art world is going down that route. Because if you look at the history of art in the world, across the world, then art has always been produced with people about things that matter to them to construct meaning and to consolidate and celebrate meaning. And so we can do that. We don't have to do what the art world seems to think we ought to do.
That philosophy, art by the people, for the people, how did that...
I can say art with the people.
My apologies, art with the people. How has that influenced your work as an artist up until now?
Well, because we have literally continued working with people in that collaborative way. I suppose what I feel is that as an artist, I don't know much about the world. I have interests in the world, but I'm not an expert on things. Working with the hospital campaign, we were working with people who were experts in their field. They knew about the health issues. So it seems to me that if I work with people who really know stuff, I can help their voice get into the public domain in a way that it is, it's visible, it's valued, and it helps create meaning in a wider society. So I continue to work in a collaborative way, even when large groups of people are involved. Because when I said I came back to participation, I've actually learned how to work with people in larger groups where it is still collaborative. So when I say collaborative, it isn't about me taking something for participants to do or just to express something. I am working with others, even if those are very young children, because of their expertise. So when I did, for example, in the term of millennium, I did a 10-year project with children aged 7 to 11 inventing a new planet in cyberspace. And there were over 1,000 children. I was interested in the way the technology would actually, whether through the technology you could work with much larger groups of people and still something meaningful would come out. And I just thought, well, if we are all working on a new society, well, what will it be? And the only way I can find out is to create a situation, a digital setup in this case, where the children then put their ideas, which they did in a visual as much as a textual way, and that will all combine to create a new planet in cyberspace, a new world. And also, at that point in the 90s, the end of the 90s, I felt politics had changed a lot, because in the 70s and 80s, it was like you knew which side you were on. You were either with them or against them. A lot of us felt that if we only worked together, we could change the world. And then I think after Thatcher, politics became a lot more individualised, and politics became more single issue. So in that situation where it was, we weren't working with a groundswell as we had been in the 70s and 80s, and it also wasn't appropriate to work in that way. I had to find other ways of doing it. And I think I thought at that moment, I'll work with younger generations to tell them they can change the world. So when they grow older, they will know that they can. So the project in Volco, that stood for a virtual online cooperative environment, kind of Volco, was about letting children know that they could change the world.
Brilliant. And you mentioned about the political climate in the late 70s and early 80s. Can you tell me about when and how you became politicised?
Yes, that's interesting. I always, even as a young child, I had a concept of fairness. So I always felt quite strongly about things in terms of being fair and equal. And I think then just through working with people who I saw were working for the good, working to with an interest in people's health rather than saving money, you know, it just seemed to make sense to me. I mean, it was sort of, it seemed rational to me that it's better to work for a better society than it is to make money. I mean, working as an artist, there weren't huge expectations of making lots of money anyway, especially if I wasn't going to be selling work in galleries. So it just made sense, and I suppose the more I worked with people who really understood what they were doing, the more I understood the politics and where it came from and sympathised with it. So, yeah, I don't know if that explains it.
How did that lead up to your involvement with the GLC?
Yes, I might explain another project before I get onto the GLC, because what happened through doing the work I described at Bethnal Green Hospital, we then did another project where the trades councils had some money left over from that campaign, and interestingly, instead of spending it on broadsheets or whatever, they asked us as artists to work with them on how best to communicate some other issues, the wider issues about what the cuts were doing to people. That they set up a steering group, which was a really interesting way of working, because that really was about how we share our expertise. That's where I learned that. In fact, I've learned almost everything I've learned from activists, not from the art world. So at the end of that, that's called the Eastern Mental Health Project, and we produced a series of posters then on different health issues. At the beginning of the 80s, in 1979, Margaret Thatcher came into power, and one of the things that she did, her government did, was to recognise the area around the London docks. The docks weren't being used so heavily because of containerisation, and they were docking further down river. So there was quite a lot of land that was empty, and was had corrugated iron around it. So the warehouses were being used as workshops rather than warehouses. So things were changing. And the areas, this very big area in the London docks, obviously this is how London became great, through its trade around the docks. The Thatcher government treated it as an empty area, really, but thousands of people were living there, living anywhere. And consultation had gone on between the boroughs. They were all Labour boroughs. How they would regenerate that area. Actually, the word regeneration didn't exist then, redevelop the area, but to meet the needs of local people. But when the Thatcher government came in, they just saw it as a big piece of real estate with a view of the river, basically. And so because they'd been working with the trade council and they saw what we could do, they came to us and said, could we do a poster about it? Now, because people are very organised, as I've already mentioned, in East London, and for good reason, because East London is the industrial area. It's where people come in. Immigration has happened through the docks and people have settled, but it hasn't been easy. People have had to organise in order to survive. So it's the most organised area I've ever come across. And in each area around the docks, all the tenants and action groups had already federated themselves into action groups for their area. There was no such thing as the London Docklands at that point. It was Wapping, Isle of Dogs, Southwark, Bermondsey, etc. And so there were all these groups that were representative groups. And this was real democracy at work. So when we were asked to make a poster, we needed to do research for the poster. We went and talked to all these groups. Well, they all said to us almost the same thing. This is really big. This issue is really big. It needs a big poster. So we need really big posters, not ordinary posters. Okay. Don't know how to make really big posters, but we take that on board. And they said also we need to be able to tell people in more depth about the issues, because there's so much going on. This is going to affect, you know, jobs and houses, healthcare, services, everything is going to be affected if they do what they're planning. What they were planning, actually, was to, they made a change, there was a new Act of Parliament brought in that changed the powers so that the government could vest land away from local authorities. That means just take it, steal it, take it away from democratically elected local authorities. And they set up a development corporation so they could give that land to the development corporation. And that still happens. If you hear of any regeneration area now that has a UDC, an urban development corporation, that's what they're doing. It's those powers they're using. Anyway, so that everyone knew who lived there how big these issues were, important political issues, not just about, it was about the lives of people living there, but you know, the background to it were these huge political changes. So they said we need to tell people in more depth about what's happening. We also need help with our individual campaigns, because they were all doing their own, you know, in each area where things were happening, they were having their own campaigns. They said we need help with graphics and posters and visual material, and also we need a photographic record of what's going on. And, you know, they said the media basically represents us in its own way, and we want to be able to have our own source of photographs so we can actually draw on them when we represent ourselves. So we came up with a 4-point plan of big posters, which turned into what's now called photo murals, travelling exhibitions, which were sort of laminated and went on screens. This took 10 years, this process, so this wasn't quick. We didn't have any money to start with. Graphics work and a photo archive. And then basically, when in trying to get this going, we went to the Tower Hamlets Arts Committee, a very good, interesting arts committee, which had representatives of local people on it from tenants groups, etc. And they gave us some money for materials. We went to the GLC that had just gone from being conservative to Labour and had then voted in Ken Livingstone and his group as leader. So it went from the most right-wing, we were under the most right-wing government this country's ever had, and the GLC went not just Labour but left Labour. And we went to the GLC to say, we're trying to do this project, could we have, we want to build this big billboard thing. We didn't know the word photo at the time. We had the money to build it, and because we didn't want to use advertising hoardings, they were in the wrong place, and they said to us, why do you only want one? That would never happen now. Because I think, you see, the GLC was very clever in a way that it did things, because it didn't have a lot of power, but it could have a lot of influence. And so it had no jurisdiction over Docklands. But on the other hand, what it did is it supported all the people who were getting together and organising around the London Docklands. So it supported the Joint Docklands Action Group, it supported ourselves. Now we became the Docklands Community Poster Project, and you could call us the cultural arm of a campaigning community. So we worked the campaign. Sometimes, because the artefacts are the things that remain, people confuse what we did with the campaign. That wasn't the case. We were a cultural arm of something that was a highly organised, very a hugely democratic process, self-organised by local communities. And the GLC recognised that and supported the people who were in it. And so that's how the GLC came to have an influence over Docklands. And that's how we eventually, when they set up the Community Arts Subcommittee, that's how we eventually got funded and we were there for 10 years doing that work, basically.
Tell me more about the Community Arts Subcommittee.
So, when the GLC first set up, they always had a remit for the arts, and they used to fund, as I understand, about 5 centres of excellence, what used to be called centres of excellence. And even when those were required to do community programming, they just had an education program tacked on. So I believe it was something like £5 million went to 5 different organisations, so £1 million to each, more or less on the nod. It was all done by a civil servant called Lord Birkett. So there was hardly any committee discussion about any of this. Well, I'm not going into what the GRC did with everything else, because you'll probably interview other people, but in the arts, what they did is that they took some of that £5 million to put into other committees. So they set up a community arts subcommittee, an ethnic arts committee, and I think some of it went through the women's committee as well. And so the community arts subcommittee was a proper legal committee of the council, and they invited, it was the advisor, it was chaired by Tony Banks, who was brilliant, a brilliant politician, very astute. I think he'd worked in the media industry, at television. He understood the issues very well, and his advisor was Alan Tompkins, who you might be interviewing as well. And between them, they set up this committee, inviting people from across the spectrum of the arts in London, and then invited applications from, it had to be from organisations, you couldn't apply as an individual, but from organisations who were doing any sort of art that benefited communities. Then the committee would visit all the shortlist and really spend some time with them and try and understand what they were doing. So although there was an application form, I have to say the funding was completely different to what it is now, in the sense that it was rigorous, but it wasn't about box ticking. You know, you had to be wanting to make a difference to a community, or some communities. You had to be, your work as an artist had to be, have a social value. Basically, the value of it was ascertained by the people who visited. So we all went and and it was quite common then. Even the Arts Council used to have peer assessment boards of artist assessors. This really makes sense, because it means that people who are experts in their field are assessing other people. It's also spreading information about what happens out there. It was a very good way of doing things. It was done by the Arts Council and the Regional Arts Associations, and they've all dropped it down. It's all officer-led. So then that's what the GLC did. And then we would come back to committee, and we would debate those organisations to decide on who got the funding. So it wasn't easy. There were no just easy handouts. And we had to think about what art meant and what is culture. And so, for example, when the Dagger and Baton Twirlers applied, which was a girls' group of baton twirlers, and we had a long debate about whether this was art or whether this was just, you know, these were girls who couldn't play sport and therefore they were being shunted off into some, you know, lesser activity. And baton twirlers arrived and they were performing outside. And we had a long debate, and we decided it was an art form. It was their own art form, and they got their money. I'm saying this to explain that the funding was rigorous, but it wasn't box ticking. It wasn't evaluation heavy. You know, there were, yes, you had to write a report on what you'd done, but it wasn't as it is now, which is the way public funding tends to happen now, is that the funders have very particular ideas about what they think is good practice, which I think that's not their position to impose, because they don't know their administrators. And what they often do is they look at what they think is good practice and then try and distill it and impose it. So I have a situation where I've been wanting to make an application to, say, the Arts Council, and they wanted to do these sort of things. I said, no, I can't do that. And somebody said, but that came from the way you used to work. And I said, well, that's fine for that project, but I might do three projects in three different ways. So you can't just impose a way, you know, a process on me. And even where the Arts Council say, oh, we just have grants for the arts and it's for everybody, it isn't, because if you look at what the questions are and how you are required to write answers for all, you know, about 8,000 words with particular answers for all these questions, then it actually guides your project into something that they've already decided. And what I'm saying is the model we have then wasn't that. because projects were looked at for what they were, and they were judged on those terms. And so it was critiqued, they were debated, but it wasn't just all about whether you do what the funder says and then tick the boxes to say if that's happened. If it didn't work well, they wouldn't get funded again. And what happened over that period is that there was a resurgence of the arts in London. It was the most fantastic time to be in London. There were festivals everywhere. There was community print shops, community video, community photography projects. It wasn't just about taking arts to the people, which I think a lot of arts institutions are always seeing about. Even now, arts policy is very much about giving access to the arts to people. This wasn't about access. This was about involving people in the arts, because creative expression is a human right and should be a human right. In fact, I know it's built into the Constitution for South Africa, the new Constitution for South Africa, that creative expression is one of your human rights that comes not that far down the list after a right to shelter and enough food and the rest of it. So that's why it was such an amazing time for the arts.
Can you tell me about any memorable moments from those marches and festivals at that time?
Well, I suppose the memorable thing from my own project, because we didn't just do the activities I told you about, and I should say it wasn't just me, myself and Peter. There were six people employed in the organisation doing different roles. But I think the most exciting one probably was the People's Armadas to Parliament. That happened because around Docklands, all the groups would have meetings. They were coordinated by the Joint Docklands Action Group, which I said was funded by the GLC, but it was set up by all those federated groups around the Docklands, who then appointed staff who were themselves planners and organisers, etc., and then formed the committee, the management committee. So the Joint Docklands Action Group was managed by the people of Docklands. And one of their tasks was to just go around, there'd be meetings held in all the different areas, and they would go around coordinating these and holding these meetings, and we would go to all the meetings as well. And at one meeting in Wapping, somebody said, "Do you know, I think it's time to take another petition to Parliament." And somebody else said, "Well, actually, they're on the river and we're on the river. Why don't we take it on the river? We need a boat." And somebody stood up and said, "Well, I'm a lighterman in Wapping and I have a barge. Would you like to take it on the barge?" And then somebody said, "Well, can we decorate the barge? Oh, Docklands Community Poster Project can do that." Anyway, so it went from group to group, and people were saying, "Well, if the barge is going, can we come too?" So eventually, when I say the first armada, there were three armadas, there were 1,000 people on the river. So there was this barge which we, as the Docklands Community Poster Project, we coordinated all the arts groups in the area. The JDAG, the Joint Docklands Action Group, coordinated all the other groups. And so we had decorated the barge with a banner which was in the shape of a dragon. So the dragon was in the shape of the river that runs through Docklands. And also it's a symbol of fight back in a lot of cultures. The dragons are from the underworld, so like Jordan the dragons, where the state against the underworld. It became the symbol of Docklands fight back with t-shirts and banners and badges and letterheadings. So that was the main barge, and that was there were a series of banners around it that were printed by the basement print workshop, which is at the base in Cable Street at the Basement Arts Project. And the barge was we had the lighterman who was actually managing the vessel, but then we had all the rest of it coordinated by somebody from a group called Cultural Partnerships, who are based in Hackney. So a colleague, Graham Downs, was on the barge making it all happen. And then following that, there was a flotilla of pleasure boats being hired decked out with banners and balloons, and we all sailed to Parliament, basically. And it was one of those moments that is, you know, you can go on a march and you can feel the sense of people there, but go sailing down the river to Parliament, and there was music, and in fact, the second Armada, a lot of people had written songs and poems, and so we had a whole barge full of musicians, so the sound going down the river was amazing. And also at one of the Armadas, the Graham from Partships was a pyrotechnics expert. So we, on the third Armada, I think, is we sailed, first of all, downriver to Woolwich, where the LDC offices had moved to, and we circled there to cannon fire. And so it is those moments that actually make you feel, wow, I think we have some power here. And also just sort of brings tears to your eyes. You know, when you think about the sort of protest where you're sort of holding up a placard in the rain, the trouble with that, and this is what the Docklands communities learned very, very early on, is that you're giving all the power to the people who you're seeing in authority. You're in opposition, you're still seeing them as the power givers. When you start taking back the power, that's when you're really strong. And in fact, that's represented in the images of the photo murals that we made. As we made them, we just responded to what was happening. And then what we did is each time, and this was funded by the GLC, needless to say, then the whole flotilla would end up in Jubilee Gardens, which was again given us to, that GLC gave to us the first time we had a big marquee there, and it was a cross between a community festival and a political rally. And the reason it was like a political rally is that the strategy of the campaigners was, you know, these issues were really big. So the selling of the land was at a government level, and you couldn't change that except with the change of government. So there's a lot of things that could be done in terms of road going through here or housing to rent there or whatever, but you couldn't change the big thing of selling off the land. And so a lot of energy went into convincing Labour politicians that when the Labour Party came in, which we felt they would do at the next election, that that they would on day one start to implement plans that were in line with what the communities have been campaigning for. Because obviously they needn't. We've seen Labour governments who just carry on Tory policy, so nobody was, nobody had that much trust that they wouldn't do that. So at each of these events, there would be a political rally in which the Labour politicians would have to stand up and say what they would do from day one of getting into power. And then what we did, the Docklands Redevelopment Project, we also made these people's charters for Docklands. So the joint Docklands actually coordinated for everyone the key points, and then we made them into an A3 poster mounted on Melanie's on pulley board, so that they were given this thing that they had to take home and they had to sign up to. Now that was very powerful. The fact that there wasn't a change in government was out of everybody's control. There were three terms of Thatcherism, unfortunately, so the land got sold off. And eventually, you could say the campaign wasn't successful because of that. A lot of things have happened on the way, but I think the lessons from the campaign are still reverberating. And so these things don't go away, and they're not for nothing. But I think those Armadas were, for me, just the high point. It's all those people together and such a fun day out at the same time.
You mentioned how highly organised and coordinated all these committees were, and you talked about the community engagement, the sense of togetherness and taking back that power, which, as you said, was a success despite Thatcher's three terms in Parliament. What lessons can we take from that?
Do you mean what lessons can we take from... Say it again, sorry.
What lessons can we take from that taking back of power, that and rather than just standing in opposition to the state, really engaging the communities or as artists and as activists?
Well, I think it's because it's much better to get on and create models of what we know and what we think can happen. And we know that from very good authority of being there. And so, and you probably know about the People's Plan for the Royal Docks. I mean, that was an amazing example of that. It was when there was a plan to turn the Royal Docks into an airport, which is City Airport, as we know there now. And people in that area said, you know, actually, an airport will bring hardly any jobs. There'll be a few ground staff. We won't even get to use the airport if it's big for business people. That's true. And so we think that land can be much better used. And so the GLC had a popular planning unit, where Hilary Wainwright and Julia Rogotham both worked. So the people in North Woolwich contacted the Popular Planning Unit, and Hilary and Sheila went down there and worked with them. Of course, they did the disaster group, and so did the post project. And they came up with this very, very well-researched plan, which was showing how you could bring homes and jobs and services and everything you needed into that area, and it would work economically. It was backed by the council. It was put through every door in you, and we produced it as a document that was a bit like a colour supplement. It was a public inquiry and won, but the government was able to overturn it. So if you go to the City Airport now, we started with a public inquiry, you have to remind them that they lost. But that plan, which was something that Hilary had a direct experience of, which was the Lucas Aerospace Shop Stewards Combine plan 10 years previously. And so it was that model of how you present an alternative. And I think those lessons are directly applicable always. So in a way, the way I work now is through alternative, not so much opposition, being oppositional, not activist in that oppositional way, but through using the arts to support people to make their own bring their own ideas into the public domain. So, for example, for the last 9 years, I've been working with a group of older men in East London called the Geezers, who have ideas about, they want to know why we're not able to use the Thames or the rivers in East London to provide energy to help older people heat their homes. Because they say, you know, older people often can't even afford sheltered accommodation because they can't afford the service charge. So why is there only wind power that we hear about, and why aren't we using the power of the River Thames? I went to see them 9 years ago on an arts project, and I asked them the question about any technology that they thought would benefit themselves or the community, not knowing what they would say, and they came up with that. And 9 years later, we are still working on renewable energy. We've already tested a turbine in the Thames, and next month we will be launching what we call a stream wheel, like a floating water wheel in the Lower Lee. And that is going to actually, it's not so much heating their homes, that one is going to drive an aerator to pump oxygen into the water and keep the fish alive when the pollution levels rise. But that's all come from the geezers. You know, when I went to see them, it was the result, it was the end point of this research project at Queen Mary University, where they were looking into why the life experience of older people isn't going into the development of new technologies, because they're all being developed by young people, but the people with the most experience of life aren't informing that. And so at the end of that project, as often is the case, they tacked on some artist submissions. Well, you know, I need to start from scratch it away. So I just went to see the geezers, and I had 6 weeks really before there was going to be an exhibition. And I asked them that question, and they came up with tidal power as what they wanted to do. And I had to say, I know absolutely nothing about it, but I'll take you every step of the way as I can. And 6 weeks later, we had researched tidal power. We had found out that the Thames Barrier is an ideal barrage to put turbines on. We'd found the sort of turbines to use. I did a big visualisation of doing it, and I'd interviewed the geezers. I'd done video interviews. so they could speak about their knowledge of why this would be such a benefit to the community and why it was so important for society at large as well. So in a way, I'm still doing what I learned then. So I say I've learned everything from activists really and from people in the community. So that is like my version at the moment of an alternative. And when, for example, another project I did in, which finished in 2012, not by coincidence, was when the London Olympics was going to take place. And I knew, as many people did, that despite all the hype, there wasn't going to be anything in it for young people, really. So I thought, well, we can still use it. We can still make some use of this. So I used it as a hook for a project and started to develop a young person's guide to East London. Now, I'd already done a small guide to the Royal Docks with young people who had actually said we would do this much wider. So I worked with 400 teenagers in different groups, schools, colleges, support groups, disability groups, youth offending teams, etc. And together they came up with, obviously not just all together, because I did it through a series of workshops, but basically together we built a website, an online guide, a real professional online guide to what's Young Person's Guide to East London, so what's good for young people in East London. And then that went online and was visited by thousands of people at the Olympics. So what I said to those young people then is that, so this is how I work with, I suppose, anybody as an expert, in the way the geezers were expert on knowing what the needs of older people were in terms of energy. And so for the young people, I basically said, look, we're creating a guide to East London for young people, but you're the only people who know. So I can help you, I can, you know, produce the website, I can show you how to take some photographs so you can help document where you think is good. But you've got to decide where you think is good, then you've got to say why it's good, and then perhaps take some photographs. I'll just make sure those photographs are really good. And so, and then that'll all go on a guide, and thousands of people will access it and use it. And of course those kids were hooked straight away, because it was their real expertise. You know, it wasn't just an art project that they would do and would go up in a classroom or something. It was real, and I think I valued their real knowledge, and they respond to that value, that valuing, and therefore that's what I mean about I come back to participation in a big way, because I found a way that you can actually still work with even large groups of people, as long as each person has a sense of ownership in what you do, as long as their ideas go into it, and as long as I respect those ideas, and as an artist, I can help to frame those ideas so when they appear in the public domain, they're at their best. So if a child isn't very good at drawing, I'm not going to put their drawing to represent something, but their imagination is fantastic. So I, for example, for the Volco project I mentioned earlier, you know, it's a lot of it is visual, and I get the kids to choose objects, scan them, photograph them, put them together, write some things, then it goes into big, lovely colours and whatever. So it's all theirs. It's all theirs, and it all looks fantastic. It's all theirs, and it all looks fantastic. So that's how I now work, in a way. I work with people as experts, and I'm a sort of a means through which this stuff can get into the public domain.
Fantastic. Can you talk me through back in the 70s and 80s, how different was your approach to engaging with the community and making sure that the experts that you were working with did have that sense of ownership and that you were bringing the best out of them and still have the committee's idea of the campaign in mind?
Oh, do you mean in the 80s?
Yes.
Oh, well, actually, what I omitted, I'm glad you asked the question, because what I omitted to talk about was a very important part of that project. I mentioned that with the health work, that the Trades Council set up a steering group. And, in fact, other artists used to say to us, because there was members of the Trades Councils, not Trades Council, Trades Health Workers Unions, health campaigns, and ourselves as artists. Another artist used to say to us, isn't that like design by committee? You know, and you're the lowest common denominator, and does it mean you can't make good decisions as artists? In fact, it was opposite. It was really stimulating because everybody was sharing their expertise, but they weren't trying to tread on each other's toes. So the trade unions were saying, I can get that poster, you ought to move that a bit further, they'll use a different colour. They weren't telling us about colours, and we weren't telling them about the issues. They would look at the images we produced and talk about what it meant. Is this saying the right thing? And what, if not, what does it need to say? So when we came to set up the Docklands Community Poster Project, we took that model and we immediately set up a steering group from all those groups I told you about that represented the different areas of Docklands. And they actually met. They came together, which was a great accolade for us, because they came together to begin with once a month to talk about what was needed, what needed to be communicated about Docklands and how we should do it. And that's, so we talked about the photo murals, where they should be sited, what the content should be, you know, what they're about. So the first sequence, and I say sequence because they changed over time. They're like a bit like slow motion animation. I could describe that a bit more. We built these, we didn't use advertising hoardings, we built these structures. And each structure had 18 panels, three down, six across. Because we had to work out how to do these big images. You couldn't just print them because there wasn't that sort of printing there. You couldn't just do a one-off. So we did them photographically. So we did the artwork, sort of about A1, AO. That was photographed in 18 sections. Each section was blown up photographically into a black and white photograph, 3 foot by 4 foot. I don't know what it is in centimetres. Pasted onto a wooden backing board, hand-coloured, because we couldn't do it in colour, there was no colour printing at that time, really, that would work. And then sealed with yacht varnish, and then taken up ladders and screwed into the backing board of the photo mural. And then together that made up the whole image. But because we had to take them down bit by bit, and then the GLC funded us for, we built 8 different photo mural sites. We had to fix an operation at any one time, but some were temporary. And so we decided, well, we can take these down, and so you have an image of what of the next coming through. And we became quite creative about that. So it was a little bit like a very slow motion animation process. So going back to the steering group, we would talk about what that sequence should be. So the first one was started with a question of what's going on behind our backs, which is what everyone was asking. And then it moved from that into something that somebody said at a public meeting on Docklands. He stood up and said, do you know what's happening here? Is big money's moving in and pushing out local people. So that was our next image. So we hadn't thought about the whole sequence all the way through. We were just responding. And our steering group sort of were the group that, that said, you know, okay, we need an exhibition now on the housing, or we need posters on this or something. So, and they were really valuable, really, I mean, valuable isn't even the word. They were the core of the Docklands Community Poster Project. The community members were in the majority. It was finally consolidated as a community co-op. So that was our constitution. The community members were a majority, so it really was a community-led project, even though Peter and I were direct artistic directors. I think we just called artist coordinators at the time. But that's how it worked, and that's why it was successful.
And in your own personal life, what was the response to your involvement in these creative campaigns and in politics?
What do you mean in my personal life?
What did your friends and family think about your involvement?
They were my friends and family. That was my life. I mean, Peter was my partner. And most of my friends were people I've worked with. So I felt, what can I say? I mean, When I had children, I remember my oldest child, when he was a baby, I was making the dragon van of the Armada, and I had to hang him in his baby bouncer on a beam in the studio while we made out the banner. So everyone was involved, so I can say.
And the public perception?
Do you mean of the art or the campaign?
Both.
I think in terms of the art, there was still interest at the time in political sort of work, but we were very, very much outside of the art world. We're becoming more and more outside of the art world. In fact, we went to, you may know the Whitechapel Gallery. We went to the director of the Whitechapel Gallery at the time to say, at the end of this period, to say, could we bring all the work together? Because it would be great to show it somewhere like East London. Whitechapel actually was built with a remit to serve the people of East London. And he said, I don't think you can show that sort of work in a gallery. You don't have to show it outside. We said, we already do show it outside. But, you know, it just wasn't going to go in a gallery. In fact, it has been shown more since. It was shown in, I think in the 90s, it started to be regarded as a historical document. And we showed it in Barcelona. We showed it in Madrid last year. And now there's some people at the University of West of Scotland have put in a bid to show it in Edinburgh and London in the next couple of years. So people have come back to it. We had to accept that after the 80s, that in a way we had to carry on even though the art world wasn't interested. But now people are interested. There's a thing called socially engaged art practice now. And although the thing is, this work was never actually, because it never was really part of the art world, it's still largely overlooked, even though I think people who know about anything about history see it as a precursor to a lot of things going on. But like yourself, you know, there's a young generation that don't know that a lot of this stuff took place. But that's the reason I wrote my book. That actually joins up the dots. And I think there are other people who are interested now in pulling together the knowledge of the different generations and see what the lessons are. And I teach art and social practice. And, for me, what I'm doing is passing on the lessons, in a way, which is what my book is about as well. Because I don't want young people now to actually reinvent the wheel. And they can do something different, because obviously times are different. But there are lessons that are also useful, even if you want to change them. So that's why I'm interested in bringing the work now into the public domain again. Or other people are, and I'm interested in passing on that information.
Could you explain what socially engaged art practice is, please?
Yeah. Well, to be honest, it really just means anybody who's working with people. But in practice, there is some work that is very much in the same ilk as what we were doing. There's quite a lot of institution-led, because it's become quite fashionable now, and so there's a lot of institutions who now want their own sort of social practice. So money comes through commissioning, and that means, and a lot of artists at biennials get asked, you know, do this, are invited to do this sort of work. So you have to be a bit careful, because it can mean, because it does really mean any art that works with people, that some of this work might be quite meaningless in terms of any wider social remit. Getting people to do things for artistic reasons, you know, well, it's fine, but it isn't what I do. I'm interested in asking the needs of social change. So social change is my aim, not creating an artwork. So there is a wide spectrum of different sorts of art, either for social change or for the art world, really. But I think what was quite useful to me is that there is a writer on this area called Grant Kester. He's very good. And He's in America, but he's researched worldwide. This was worked worldwide quite well. And when I read his last book, which was called The One and the Many, he's looking at this sort of work as a global phenomenon. And I think when I looked at the fact that I really felt strongly in the 70s and 80s that this, as I mentioned, this is one of the ways that art is going, or was going, that I was then quite shocked in a way when the 90s came and the art, there was a real backlash in the art world. I mean, we had the young British artists. It was the equivalent of what happened with Thatcherism, if you see what I mean. So it was right back into the gallery and no interest whatsoever. And all that sort of work was called community arts that people wrote off as sort of bad murals or whatever. So I was quite despondent that that happened, although we just carried on. But it seemed to happen in the States as well. So that meant that it seemed quite widespread. But then what happened is that when I read Grant's book and I recognised a bit more about what was going on in the rest of the world, that actually it had carried on. It was just that we had Thatcher, the States had Reagan, and we both had right-wing backlashes, but not the whole world. And so there are artists globally who are doing work that is with communities, sometimes for very little money, you know, just doing it really for its own sake. And it's very, very, you know, energising to see that that's happening. So I think we were right. I think there was a movement amongst artists that this is where art needed to go. Obviously there's different sorts of art. I don't mind some art for galleries. I like art. But I think there is a whole area of art which is much more concerned with engagement and less concerned with the art market. I think that's very encouraging. And that's why I've now set up a new MA so I can teach some of that. Yes, I think it's positive, potentially very positive.
You mentioned that you were inspired by
Frank Kester.
Yes, and John Hartfield and even Russian artists, and you mentioned that there was a rise in political art at the time. What do you think the Thatcher era would have looked like without those creative cultural campaigns?
Well, it would have looked like what a lot of people saw it as anyway. I mean, it was just, you know, it's interesting. I hear people, you know, on the radio, when we talk about the 80s, and they say, oh, it's all about power dressing and Ferraris and Porsches and rising property values. So that's what some people saw. So that it would have been that. I mean, Docklands would have been much as it is. There were some significant victories. For example, there would have been a road going through the middle of Wapping and decimated the middle of Wapping. And we did achieve housing for rent along the river at Cherry Gardens, south of the river. So there were certain things that are definitely great victories. But I think it will be what a lot of the rest of the world sees that era. It would have been about individualism, getting rich, you know, and what was beginning to happen in the art world, which was sort of rather sensational art that sold for a lot of money.
And what do you think was the key successes that were won?
When? In the 80s?
Yes.
I mean, through the Docklands work. I think recognising that all that was possible, and also recognising that even if we didn't win all of it, what could have been possible. I think it gave a lot of people a glimpse into the fact that this can work. You can have democracy working in this way that is by the people. You know, it isn't, you don't have to just think that government does everything. That politics isn't just about government, it's about how you live your life, and you can do things as an ordinary person to make a difference and to make things better. And I think it just gave a lot of people at the time a buzz and a glimpse into that possibility. And if they've got it, they can pass it on. You see what I mean? It's come back, hasn't it? So it owes something to the fact it was here before. I think, you know, we haven't talked about feminism, which obviously was a really big thing at the time, and I've only talked about male influences in the art, but feminism was a huge issue at the time, and, you know, that's come back as well. And I remember reading a book at the time which said, there's always been a women's movement this century. And so, and I thought, oh, isn't that strange? I thought it was just now. But actually, it reminded me that these things go in waves, and therefore, the last wave really matters to the next wave. So, you know, what's happened is a dip in between. It's not what is, it's not what exists. That we are, we can come back, and we come back in a different form, but actually, there is still a potential for socialism. Even if the socialism looks different because times are different, but there is still a desire for that, and people who are willing to do things not for personal gain, but because the better society. And so that's, I think it's very encouraging, and it's very lovely to see it now. I can't tell you how it fills me with joy to see young people now who are actually wanting to make things happen.
What do you think the future holds for the current generation, particularly activists and creative campaigners?
It's hard to say what the future holds when we've had Brexit and we've got Trump, because that all looks so dire. So I will try and remove those things from the equation. Yes, if it wasn't for those things, I think there is a chance to put some things in place now. You have to remember that they won't last forever, and so this will be the top of a wave, which will eventually go away, but it might be here for some time. Quite a lot could be achieved in that time. And I think the more joining together we do, the better. Because in a way, the worst side of things are happening about divisiveness, and I suppose I go through a process in my own work of joining up. It's all about joining up, because it's that sense that actually things do belong to each other. You can support each other. You could be different to somebody, but you all share. There's things you all share. And it doesn't matter if you differ in some ways, because you come together on the things that you share, and you make each other stronger. And so I do believe that they're, you know, human beings do have the capacity to make a better society and can do it. And actually, things are so much better now, aside from Brexit and Trump, than they were then. I mean, you know, I look back at that video we did for the Ben Green Hospital campaign. I only saw it last week for the first time. It's just been digitised. I mean, I saw it then, in the 70s, but it's just been redigitalised. And I was horrified how male it was. You know, and I was aware then, you know, of feminism, and I was a feminist, but it reminded me of how much we needed feminism. And the fact that I can look at it now and think, oh my God, this is ridiculous. It's because all the doctors were male, the patients were male, everyone interviewed was male, even my partner did the voiceover. And so, and I just thought, well, we wouldn't do that now. You just wouldn't do it. So I think an awful lot of gains have been made that perhaps you only get a sense of how much when you look back to them. So things have moved on and things have improved. There is, despite the lack of equality, there is much more equality in the world. I mean, look at what happened to gays. I mean, look what people went through in you know, only a few decades ago. So I just think that however imperfect things are now, that there have been huge gains. And I think when those gains are just not individual, but they are played out in a bigger arena, like through the GLC, like the confidence that was gained through having a community arts subcommittee, a women's committee, an ethnic arts subcommittee, just that confidence that that's okay and that supports some people to develop, that actually counts for an awful lot, and it's sort of the ripples go on. And so I think it's not always tangible to see, to trace each thing that has happened, but I'm in no doubt that all that hadn't happened with the GLC and all the other initiatives, socialist initiatives at the time, we wouldn't be in the place we are now. So things don't change just because time changes. You know, things can get worse. Things can stay very, very rigid. And so I think an awful lot was achieved, actually.
You mentioned the importance of joining together and the fact that the people you worked with were your friends and family and all of these networks that you formed. In light of that, were there any divisions?
Oh God, yes. Oh, it wasn't all sweetness and light. No. Oh my God, no. No, I mean, the more collective things are, the more difficult it is to manage. And yes, it's no coincidence that in the middle of the Dotcast Community Process Project, which was a community plot, that I did training in conflict resolution. You know, I was also involved in a collective, another collective in East London, which was very torn apart. And so I think most people who've been involved in collectives know. And there was a very good paper written in 1979 called The Tyranny of Structurelessness I can probably remember who it is. Anyway, I can't remember who it is for now. And that was about that it's actually, if there's no structure, then people make their way by personal power. So that's how, if you have a collective where everyone feels that they're equal, but you have no, you haven't sorted out different roles and responsibilities, that the people there are people who will grab power just because it's there to be taken. And so I did this training, because it's very cheap training, and I think it cost £5 or something, it was, you know, at the time. And then I realised if I stayed on with this organisation, Human Conflicts and Change, that if I became a neighbourhood conciliator, I could then receive more training. So I did eventually stay for 6 years and worked as in my spare time as a voluntary mediator and conciliator. And those skills are absolutely valuable for me. Not just about where there is actual conflict, but in my work, where I'm collaborating with a lot of people, I now have no fear of going into situations where there's a lot of different ideas, because I sort of know that difference is positive. Difference is what makes new things happen. And what you have to do is just be aware of what everyone's needs are. I would always, in a collaboration, I'd always try and find out what everyone really wants in a situation. And I remember a trainer, a mediation trainer once said, you know, when you go through the process of mediation and you ask each person what they want and whatever, and she said, if none of it works, all you've got left is creativity. And I thought, well, I can do that bit. And in a way, a lot of my projects are really like that creativity. It's the Volco project, the Flanders Cyberspace, all those 1,000 children who took part. The cyberspace is the safe place where people could come together fairly anonymously, and they could work together. Because I linked up kids here with kids in other places who they didn't know. They just thought they were Balkans from another settlement. And therefore, they didn't dwell on their differences. They dwelt on, because they're all Balkans. They were really interested in their differences. So in a way, I think the divisions were really part of it. I mean, feminism, you know, now it's delightful to see the research of feminism. And I just sometimes wonder if young feminists know what the feminist movement was like, which was as positive, I mean, you can't say that it wasn't as positive, you know, there's no words to describe how important it was. But, you know, there were so many factions that there were people whose lives were destroyed by the factionalisation. You know, radical feminists, socialist feminists, you know, which pigeonholes you put in, are you a lesbian, are you heterosexual? Sometimes being heterosexual felt, you know, a bit like dodgy, that you shouldn't really be there, or if you had a relationship with a man. But On the other hand, it was all very important. But yes, we had to manage an awful lot of issues, and I think it's good to learn some of those skills to manage them before they come up again.
What?
Also, no, I should say the other thing that I learned from it in terms of the roles and responsibilities. So I learned that structure is fine, and I learned that authority is fine. Authority isn't power. So through my training in conflict resolution, I did end up as a trainer to organisations in conflict, which was also very useful. That often where there is a conflict, and it usually comes across as a personal clash, but 10-1 you'll find that it's an issue of roles and responsibilities. So if you're very clear about these things from the outset, then there's much less likely to be a problem. So when I set up my current organisation, C-Space, I had no qualms about setting it up as a regular charity. You know, I'm the artistic director, and there's a board of trustees. And when I've had freelance staff, you know, I manage them and I supervise them and give them appraisals, and because it makes everyone knows where they are. You know, if I'm working with somebody else, I don't just suddenly feel that I'm on an equal part of them, and I've just come into this organisation and it's just a job to me, to be honest, and then suddenly I can say something and that person who's been working here for 20 years or something, I can just say, well, I think that's rubbish, and you know. So it really matters that you actually identify where people are in that structure, and you recognise that it's not about power relations, it's just about making things work efficiently and everyone being where they are and getting what they need from it.
You've talked about the importance of those facilitation and mediation skills, and again the structure and roles and responsibilities. What would you say to someone on the street that wants to get involved in activism? Do they have to equip themselves with those skills? What would you say to someone like that?
Well, I think first of all, you start where you are, and you do you. You work for something that you feel passionate about. I think you just... I don't think you can go to training to be an activist. But I suppose you can just be aware of those issues. So I would... you know, I teach my students something I learned in conflict resolution. It's one of the basic skills. It's called active listening. And it's how you really hear what somebody has to say and how you draw out from somebody what they think, and help. In a way, I suppose, you see, I do it in my projects because I'm trying to draw out people's creativity and find out what they've got to offer, whatever. So it's sort of second nature now, but it isn't second nature to other people. I learnt it, and other people can learn it. So I think active listening is a really basic skill that is very useful to learn. And I think if you're going to work in a collective, it would be really useful to go and do some conflict resolution training. So at least you'll just have a basis to start from. But I don't think it should stop you. I don't think you should think, well, I'm not ready to be an activist yet because I've not done my training.
And what advice would you give to yourself as a young budding artist back in East London?
Yeah. About what?
About politics.
What would I give myself, myself now, tell myself this?
Yes.
Oh my God. Life isn't going to be easy. Yeah. Life's bloody hard. It throws things at you. And you just have to carry on, basically. You just have to learn how to put one foot in front of the other, and when life throws difficult stuff at you, you have to keep moving and never stop. I think that's what I would say.
And what would you say to a young person in this current generation?
I would say, if you're going to be an artist, find another means of earning a living. Because because I know what the arts funding situation is and I know what it's like. So when I'm a student, I think to earn your living as an artist now, even the way I did, which was through fundraising and stuff, would be really, really hard. I'm not saying anything's impossible, but it would be even harder than what I did, and that was hard. So I think that's what I would say. I would say, yeah, I think I, because also I'm a mother, so I would say find a way of earning a living. But that's what my parents said to me, of course I didn't. that's the nature of being a parent. I would also say, follow your heart, do what you have the energy for, don't do what's something that seems sensible. Because you can see people who've lived their lives doing something sensible and think, oh, at some point I'll do that thing I really want to do. And, well, why not do it? I mean, I just think you need to follow. I think you need to go where your energy is. If your heart's not in it, don't do it. And that sort of might sound contradictory to be earning your living. But you can earn your living as long as you get, as long as you're focused on the thing that really matters. You can do other things, and you don't lose. Then you don't lose your way. Because I think, yes, I think I've learned that that when you're on your path, let's say, so you're following your energy, it's a sort of a flow, and it takes you there. It just takes you there. You don't have to try. You go with it. And I've also learned that when you have a gut feeling about it, about something, that it's almost certainly right. And just telling yourself that it may not be right isn't really helpful. But if you have a gut feeling about something, really you ought to go with that, because your body is a much stronger mechanism than your brain on its own. And I think sometimes your whole being can process something and it gives you a message and it tells you that you need to do this. And your brain could be saying, oh, don't do it yet, or no, don't, it wouldn't be sensible. But you sort of know that that's what you need to do or don't need to do. And I would just say that you need to go with it.
That's brilliant advice. And lastly, any final words you'd like to share?
About?
Anything.
Oh, only that I think it's fantastic that this work is being done about the GLC and the fact that there are young people now who actually are willing to take the time to look back, you know, to the past and also take the time to interview us old folks and find out what we've got to say and feel we have something to say and want to learn and take that information and go forward in an informed way. So I feel delighted about the way what I see is happening amongst the younger generation.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for speaking to me, Lorraine. I've had an incredible time listening to you speak about your journey as an artist from the 70s and the 80s up until now, and your involvement in the creation of British culture and the creation of what London is today, and our history as activists and as campaigners. And I've really enjoyed speaking to you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. I've enjoyed it as well.